happy birthday today to Darcel Boyack of Sioux City, Brenda Fuller of Waterloo, Don O'Loughlin of Marion, Mark Rodebush of Colfax, and Harold Steele of Wayland. If today is your birthday and you did not hear your name, please give us a call to make sure that we get you on our birthday list. You can call us at 515-243-6833 or toll free from anywhere in Iowa at 1-877-404-4747. We're so glad to have you with us. If you're listening on your television, internet, or mobile device, and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call. We need to know who is listening and how you're listening in order to keep our services free. You can catch a replay of today's reading at 6 p.m. and 1 a.m. here on IRIS. Today's show, as well as many of our other newspapers and programs, are available as podcasts on our website, iowaradioreadings.org. And that does it for today's announcements. Here's Linda with our next story.
Well, here's an article still in the Metro section. Officials say superintendent dies due to coronavirus. A Southern Iowa school district superintendent has died after becoming ill with COVID-19, according to district officials. The Mormon Trail Community School District in Humiston shared on Facebook Sunday that Superintendent Kerry Phillips lost his battle with COVID today. Once a saint, always a saint, district officials wrote in reference to the school's mascot. It was not immediately clear how long Phillips had been ill. The district has 209 students in grades preschool through 12th this year, according to enrollment data from the Iowa Department of Education. According to his LinkedIn profile, Phillips had been Mormon Trail's superintendent for several years. According to his obituary and LinkedIn profile, Phillips was an undergraduate alum of Buena Vista University and earned a master's in education from Drake University. His career in education included work for Indian Hills Community College, Simpson College, and Buena Vista. He also taught and was a principal at the Cardinal Community School District and worked as superintendent for the Harmony Community School District in southern Iowa, southeast Iowa, before coming to Mormon Trail. Phillips is not the first Iowa educator to die after battling COVID-19. According to the privately operated Iowa COVID-19 tracker, 30 educators and school staff, including bus drivers, have died, not including Phillips, of COVID-19 since the pandemic began, although the names and ages of three were not immediately available. According to an analysis of the tracker's database, Phillips may have been the first superintendent in Iowa to die of the disease since the virus was first reported in Iowa in March 2020. According to a spokesperson for the Iowa State Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, the association isn't aware of any other superintendents to have died from COVID-19 and referred reporters to the private COVID-19 tracker for more information. The Mormon Trail District is about an hour's drive from Mount Air, another Iowa district hit particularly hard by the pandemic in recent weeks. Officials there announced last week that the district would not hold classes the first half of this week because of illness, including COVID-19, within its buildings and the community. In Wayne County, where the Mormon Trail District is located, the county hospital's walk-in clinic had to close early more than once last week due to increased illness among our providers and staff, according to the posts on the hospital's Facebook profile. The 14-day positivity rate in the county is 16.2%, and the 7-day rate is 21.4%, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. According to the State Health Department, 43.5% of the county's residents older than 5 are fully vaccinated. That figure compares to 63.6% of eligible Iowans fully vaccinated statewide.
DART cuts service on some routes due to staff shortages. Des Moines Area Regional Transit will temporarily reduce service on 7 routes Wednesday because of workforce shortages caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. By temporarily reducing service on some routes, DART will improve the reliability of our services until staffing levels improve and DART can restore services on these trips, DART spokesperson Aaron Hockman said in a news release. The Public Transit Service plans to temporarily reduce service on the following routes. Local Route 52 between Valley West and Jordan Creek. Express Route 92 to Hickman Road. Express Route 93 to 8th Street. Express Route 95, Vista inbound. Express Route 96, E.P. True inbound. Express Route 98 to Ankeny. And Express Route 99 to Altoona. Changes can be found online. In a mid-January interview, Hockman hinted that temporary service changes could be coming in order to sustain reliable levels of service on some key routes because more employees were infected by COVID-19 after the holiday season. If we do end up needing to make some temporary service reductions, it won't be as significant as the service reductions we did have to make early on in the pandemic, Hockman said at the time.
Well, I'll turn back to the nation and world information. Biden looking to prove he can rally U.S. allies. Bridging gaps has been a challenge for the president. President Joe Biden's effort to rally support, both at home and abroad, ahead of a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine, is just the latest big test of his ability to bridge ideological gaps and balance competing interests to build effective coalitions. His record so far as president suggests it's no sure thing. Biden is trying to pull off the kind of alliance on the international front that has eluded him on his domestic agenda as he faces defeats on voting rights and his signature $2.2 trillion domestic and climate spending bill. Now he faces a complicated and globally more dangerous task, keeping the West unified as it faces what White House officials say is an increasingly likely further invasion of Ukrainian territory ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin. The pileup of difficult moments is providing a major test of the twin pillars of Biden's 2020 candidacy, that he could get things done competently at home and, and restore America's standing in the world after Donald Trump's volatile 4 years in the White House. Starting with the messy end of the war in Afghanistan in the late summer, the upsurge in COVID cases into the fall, overlaid by economic concerns of inflation and labor shortages, and his issues with his legislative agenda, Biden's found himself with a weary American public who are seeing a number of unfulfilled promises, said Christopher Borick, director of the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College. The situation in Ukraine presents another test of his competency. Administration officials have been scrambling to get NATO allies on the same page with a Russian attack seen as more likely. Biden's national security aides have been working with individual European nations, the European Commission, and global suppliers on contingency plans if Russia interrupts energy supplies. The president has said repeatedly that he will not send U.S. troops to Ukraine, but he has ordered 8,500 to be on heightened alert for deployment to the Baltic region. He said he'd spoken with every NATO ally, and we're all on the same page. In fact, Biden claims there's total unanimity in the Western alliance's approach to the crisis. But there are signs of differences. Germany declined to send military aid to Ukraine, even as the U.S. and other NATO allies sent aid and looked to assist Kyiv further. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky bristled at Biden's comment last week that a minor incursion of Ukraine would result in more limited consequences for Moscow. Ukrainian officials also complained that the U.S. State Department was premature in calling on families of American embassy workers and non-essential employees in Ukraine to leave. Meanwhile, Croatian President Zoran Milanovic blamed the escalation of tensions on the Biden administration and the pressure from hawks on both sides of the U.S. political scene. French President Emmanuel Macron said Tuesday that it was a good thing the U.S. and Russia have been talking, but he noted he did not see any concrete results. Macron said he planned to speak with Putin on Friday.
San Jose approves gun insurance law. A California city voted Tuesday night to require gun owners to carry liability insurance in what's believed to be the first measure of its kind in the United States. The San Jose City Council overwhelmingly approved the measure, despite opposition from gun owners who said it would violate their Second Amendment rights and promised to sue. The Silicon Valley city of about 1 million followed a trend of other Democrat-led cities that have sought to rein in violence through stricter laws. But while similar laws have been proposed, San Jose is the first city to pass one, according to Brady United, a national nonprofit organization that advocates against gun violence. Council members, including several who had lost friends to gun violence, said it was a step toward dealing with gun violence that Councilman Sergio Jimenez called a scourge on our society. Having liability insurance would encourage people in the 55,000 households in San Jose who legally own at least one registered gun to have safes, install trigger locks, and take gun safety classes, Mayor Sam Liccardo said. The liability insurance would cover losses or damages resulting from any accidental use of the firearm, including death, injury, or property damage, according to the ordinance. If a gun is stolen or lost, the owner of the firearm would be considered liable until the theft or loss is reported to authorities. However, gun owners who do not have insurance would not lose their guns or face any criminal charges, the mayor said. The council also voted to require gun owners to pay an estimated $25 fee, which would be collected by an yet-to-be-named nonprofit and doled out to community groups to be used for firearm safety education and training, suicide prevention, domestic violence, and mental health services. The proposed ordinance is part of a broad gun control plan that Liccardo announced following the May 26 mass shooting at the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority rail yard that left 9 people dead, including the employee who opened fire on his colleagues and then killed himself. At an hours-long meeting, critics argued that the fee and liability requirements violated their right to bear arms and would do nothing to stop gun crimes, including the use of untraceable build-it-yourself ghost guns. You cannot tax a constitutional right. This does nothing to reduce crime, one speaker said. The National Association for Gun Rights and gun owner Mark Sykes sued San Jose in federal court on Tuesday. The law is unconstitutional. That was said by Harmit Dhillon, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, said on Wednesday. The law compels people to purchase insurance that does not necessarily exist and that demonstrates that this law is not a good faith attempt to do anything other than ban or burden the lawful possession of guns. Liccardo acknowledged the measure did not address the massive problem of illegally obtained weapons that are stolen or purchased without background checks. Liccardo also said gun violence costs San Jose taxpayers $40 million a year in emergency response services.
I'll read the Nation and World Watch Wire reports. From Los Angeles, Pelosi, 81, to seek re-election with Democratic majority razor thin. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced Tuesday she will seek re-election, ending speculation that she would retire as Democrats face the threat of losing control of Congress in the 2022 midterms. This election is crucial. Nothing less is at stake than our democracy, Pelosi, 81, said in an online video. By announcing she would seek a 19th term, Pelosi avoids becoming a lame duck in a year when Democrats are clinging to a fragile majority in the House and the party is under pressure to raise vast sums of money. And from New York, police say suspect in New York hospital shooting had signed in. A suspect arrested for a shooting in a New York City hospital was tracked down after he signed in at the hospital, police said Wednesday. Kieber Martinez, 25, was arrested hours after Tuesday's shooting at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx, a police spokesperson said. Police believe Martinez was the gunman who opened fire inside a waiting room at the hospital, striking another man in the arm. The victim was treated at the hospital and is expected to recover. New York City Health and Hospitals called the shooting a cowardly act. From Beirut, U.S.-backed Syrian forces capture prison from ISIS after 1 week. U.S.-backed Kurdish-led forces said they wrestled control of the last section of a prison controlled by Islamic State militants and freed a number of child detainees used as human shields. It ended a week-long assault by the extremists on one of the largest detention facilities in Syria. The attack was the biggest by the Islamic State since the fall of the group's caliphate in 2019 and came as the militants staged a number of deadly attacks in Syria and Iraq that stoked fears they may be staging a comeback. The last one is from Nairobi, Kenya. Ethiopian ministers propose ending state of emergency now. Ethiopia's Council of Ministers proposed ending the country's six-month state of emergency now, citing recent developments in the war that has raged in the Tigray and neighboring regions for over a year. Wednesday's proposal to end the state of emergency that was declared in early November must be approved by lawmakers. The proposal was announced by the government on social media. The state of emergency was imposed as Tigray forces fighting Ethiopian and allied forces moved closer to the capital.
And here are two short stories from the Associated Press. The first one from Miami Beach: capsized boat leaves 38 missing in Atlanta, in the Atlantic. The Coast Guard battled time and currents Wednesday as its planes and ships searched for 38 people missing off the coast of Florida 4 days after a suspected human smuggling boat capsized in a storm. The accident killed at least one person and left a single known survivor, and U.S. authorities launched a criminal investigation. Captain Joanne F. Burdian said the survivor told rescuers that the boat capsized Saturday evening shortly after sailing into a storm from the Bahamas. The Coast Guard was alerted Tuesday morning after the crew of a merchant vessel spotted the man sitting alone on the overturned hull of the 25-foot boat. She said finding other migrants alive is urgent. With every moment that passes, it becomes more and more dire and more unlikely that survivors will be found, she told a news conference. Crews searched around the clock, extrapolating from where the wreck was spotted about 40 miles off Fort Pierce. By Wednesday morning, crews on at least four ships and five aircraft scanned the vast area about the size of New Jersey, Burdian said. They plan to keep searching throughout the day and then reevaluate. The rescued man said he was part of a group of 40 people who left Bimini in the Bahamas, Burdian said. He said the boat capsized and no one aboard was wearing a life jacket, she added. And this story from Dallas, a man charged with gun crime in a Texas siege. A Texas man was charged with a federal gun crime after authorities said he sold a gun to a man who held four hostages inside a Texas synagogue earlier this month before being fatally shot by the FBI, the Justice Department said on Wednesday. Henry Michael Williams, 32, was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm after authorities say he sold the weapon to Maisel Faisal Akram, who used it. Henry Michael Williams, 32, was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm after authorities say he sold the weapon that Maisel Faisal Akram used when he entered Congregation Beth Israel in Coleyville, Texas on January 15 and held the synagogue's rabbi and three other hostages for hours. Akram, a 44-year-old British citizen, held hostages in the Dallas area suburb while demanding the release of a federal prisoner. The standoff ended after more than 10 hours when the temple's rabbi threw a chair at Akram and fled with the other two remaining hostages just as an FBI tactical team was moving in. Earlier Wednesday, British police said they arrested another two men in the investigation into the hostage-taking incident. Police said the two men were arrested in the northern English city of Manchester.
The Vatican defends Benedict after report false abuse. Document focuses on time as an archbishop. This from Rome. The Vatican on Wednesday strongly defended Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI's record in fighting clergy sexual abuse and cautioned against looking for easy scapegoats and summary judgments after an independent report faulted his handling of four cases of abuse when he was Archbishop of Munich, Germany. The Holy See's editorial director, Andre Tornielli, provided the Vatican's first substantial response to the report in an editorial that appeared in the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano and its media portal Vatican News. In it, Tornielli recalled that Benedict was the first pope to meet with victims of abuse, that he had issued strong norms to punish priests who raped children, and that he had directed the church to pursue a path of humility in seeking forgiveness for the crimes of its clerics. All this can neither be forgotten nor erased, Tornielli wrote. A German law firm released the lengthy report last week that had been commissioned by the German church to look into how cases of sexual abuse were handled in the archdiocese between 1945 and 2019. Benedict, the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger headed the Archdiocese from 1977 to 1982, when he was named to head the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. The report's authors faulted Ratzinger's handling of four cases during his time as archbishop, and also faulted his predecessors and successors for their own misconduct in allowing predator priests to remain in ministry. Through his secretary, the 94-year-old Benedict has said he would respond to the findings in due time. He has already acknowledged an editorial error in his own submission to the researchers about a 1980 meeting in which a pedophile priest transfer to Munich was discussed. Benedict acknowledged this week that he indeed attended the meeting, but denied that his return to pastoral work was discussed at the time. The priest later received a suspended sentence for molesting a boy. Tornielli didn't comment on the details of that case or any other, though he lamented that so much attention had predictably been paid in the media to Benedict's four-year term as archbishop. He focused instead on Benedict's tenure as prefect of the doctrine office from 1982 to 2005, and then as pope from 2005 to 2013 when he retired. While he was prefect of the doctrine office, Ratzinger in 2001 directed all cases of clergy sex abuse to be sent to his office for processing after he saw that bishops around the world were moving rapists from parish to parish rather than punishing them under the church's in-house canon law. During the final 2 years of his pontificate, Benedict defrocked nearly 400 priests for abuse.
224 species discovered in Mekong. This is datelined out of Bangkok. A monkey with ghostly white circles around its eyes is among 224 new species listed in the World Wildlife Fund's latest update on the Greater Mekong region. The conservation group's report, released Wednesday, highlights the need to protect the rich biodiversity and habitats in the region, which includes Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Myanmar. The species listed were found in 2020, but last year's report was delayed. The monkey is called the Popa langur, as it lives on the steep hillsides of the extinct Mount Popa volcano in Myanmar. It was the only new mammal. There are also dozens of newly identified reptiles, frogs and newts, fish, and 155 plant species, including the only known succulent bamboo species found in Laos. The Mekong region is a biodiversity hotspot and home to tigers, Asian elephants, Saola, an extremely rare animal also called the Asian unicorn or spindlehorn, and thousands of other species. Including this latest list, scientists have identified more than 3,000 new species in the region since 1997, the World Wildlife Fund said. Scientists used measurements and samples from museum collections to compare and identify key differences with features of the newly discovered animals and plants, the report said. Studying such differences can help determine the range of species and threats to their survival. Thomas Ziegler, a curator at the University of Cologne's Institute of Zoology, said in introducing the report. And that brings us to the halfway point of today's Des Moines Register here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All programs heard on IRIS are intended for the use of Iowans who have a print disability. If you are not a registered IRIS listener or would like more information about our service, please give us a call at 243-6833. That's area code 515-243-6833. Or call us toll free at 1-877-404-4747. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. We are glad to have you listening. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Back from our short break. I'm Dorothy Hockenberg, and my partner at the other microphone for the next 90 minutes is, big surprise,
Susan
Mary
Lester.
Frances Evans. We will be reading the opinions, obituaries, sports, and other news from today's Des Moines Register and USA Today. We will wrap up with Dear Abby and a weather recap. We'll start with the first opinion by Rika Basu. By attacking Indira Shoemaker, other council members have forfeited claims to progressiveness unless they reverse that malign vote. For as long as I can remember, disenchanted young people fed up with impenetrable power structures that served narrow constituencies have been told to do the hard work of running for office and leading differently. Des Moines' Indira Shoemaker did just that, and brilliantly. She honed organizational skills from being a key player in the local protest movement that stemmed from George Floyd's killing by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin and others like it. She got politically savvy. A week before a Des Moines City Council meeting, she'd pick up the agenda, study up on the issues, and form an opinion. She'd talk it over with people who shared her commitment to broader representation. Then she'd attend the meeting to offer input. But the powers that be didn't always like her tone, her language, or the company she kept. Most of all, they didn't like her critiques that challenged their priorities. So soon they started looking for ways to silence her. One way was limiting the time allotted for each public speaker to 2 minutes or even less at some meetings. What a joke. as if anything meaningful can be summarized or anyone ignorant can be educated in 2 minutes. Apparently, that inability was the council's hope. Another way was by getting police to haul protesters out of meetings. Consider the irony. So Shoemaker thought bigger, ran for office, and defeated an incumbent. In the process, she inspired a legion of neighborhood residents, people hungry for a voice and a shift in priorities, to also get involved. This month, she was sworn in and fittingly made her first priority the plight of unhoused people who could die in the sub-zero temperatures that we've been experiencing. She called a special meeting to encourage creation of a 24-hour warming center. But at that meeting, as the Register reported, she was prevented from making her motion after Mayor Frank County recognized another speaker before Shoemaker and the council debated and approved a different motion. Councilman Josh Mandelbaum then called for the meeting to end before Shoemaker could make her case. Next thing you know, all the other members were teaming up to pass a measure that blocks full consideration and a vote on any proposal a member makes that doesn't have a second supporter. Oh, sure, they claim this was under consideration before. But does anyone really believe it would have been voted on or passed had it not been for Shoemaker's willingness to take on sacred cows and power brokers and speak up for the unrepresented? If so, I have a miracle cure for baldness to sell you. And as far as cures go, what will be harder to cure after this latest move is the cynicism around politics and closed-door deal-making that can only grow into greater frustration and anger by those outside the doors. Frankly, I'm not just shocked. I'm outraged. Even though I've been critical of measures coming from this council before, several members who signed on to this horrible rule are people with whom I could disagree on some things but find common ground with on others. Right now, I can't trust any of the old guard and really question what they stand for, if not the ability of a democratically elected official to govern. And by the way, they're Democrats. This isn't about party ideology. It's about making room for other strategies or points of view. While I was reading about this council maneuver to silence its youngest, newest female member, and the only one of color, a news release for a new book called The Neutrality Trap landed in my inbox. Of this book by authors Bernard Mayer and Jacqueline N. Font Guzman, it said, "As we grapple with the profoundly disruptive events of the past year, and in particular with the sense that something is seriously wrong with our capacity to deal with the most intense problems we face as a society and a world, we are challenged to rethink our whole approach to conflict." It specifically mentions racism, oppression, and global warming, and how the systemic roots of oppression are perpetuated. And it urges an understanding of the deep issues of power, privilege, and identity in contemporary societal conflicts, along with a new approach to issues of race, gender, and colonialism, and reconsideration of reliance on neutrality, objectivity, and professionalism in lieu of commitment to justice, equity, and genuine connection. I haven't read the book and hadn't known of its authors, but its conclusion that for real change to happen, we also need the wake-up calls of disruption and disorder seems to speak to exactly what Shoemaker and her constituents have been bringing to the table, and what the rest of the council has tried to shut out. Shame on them. They have now forfeited any claims to progressiveness unless they reverse that malign vote. Des Moines' true progressives may have to find ways to work around them, and with Indira Shoemaker instead.
And the political cartoon for today, good morning, Kirsten, it shows the Ukrainian border, or like a representation of the Ukrainian border, and there's a sign that says Ukraine, and on the Ukraine sign there's a just right over the border, the Ukraine side, there's a tank, and then it's got Vladimir Putin coming out the top, and the tank says Russia, and then the line that the tank is right behind says tiny incursion, and then there's another line that says slight incursion, and then it shows a representation of Joe Biden drawing a third line a little further back that says minuscule inclusion. And that was from Dana Summers of the Tribune Content Agency. Turning to our letters to the editor, our first letter comes from Jim O'Halloran Sr. of Des Moines, and he writes, "The governor is monitoring the fast-spreading Omicron variant. The interim director of the Iowa Department of Public Health is hoping we are near the peak, with 59.5% of all Iowans and 70.7% of those 18 or older fully vaccinated after 1 year of vaccination availability. Quote, Iowans will do the right thing, unquote, is clearly not enough to stop this or future viruses. Passing laws to prevent mask mandates in schools, joining lawsuits to stop mandatory masks in businesses, and at the same time hoping Omicron will decline is not managing the spread of the virus. The goal of keeping businesses open and successful is being challenged each day with worker shortages or many consumers hesitant to go to restaurants or larger gatherings. Most workers at businesses have stopped wearing masks. Most students have stopped wearing masks. The spread of the virus has increased the number of those testing positive to at least 36,731 in the past week. The 14-day positivity rate has accelerated to 24.3%. Hospitals are begging for help. Hospitals are being overwhelmed. Most Iowans are following the lead of the governor and hoping this goes away soon. But is it possible there is a better way to manage and reduce the spread and impact? Is it possible to reduce the impact on the hospitals and care workers and reduce hospitalizations and deaths?" And that letter to the editor was sent in by Jim O'Halloran, Sr. of Des Moines. Our next letter to the editor comes from Keith McKinley of Osage, and Keith writes, "In our collective preoccupation with the superficiality of skin color, we're ignoring this much deeper human commonality. Whatever color our skin, when that skin is cut, we all bleed red, and that red blood will save the life of another human being, regardless of the color of his or her skin." And that was from Keith McKinley of Osage. And the third little bit, letter to the editor, comes from Jim Zeller of Des Moines. And Jim writes, "Newt Gingrich says the January 6th committee is a lynch mob that has run amok. The irony is so palpable, I can feel it." And that was sent by Jim Zeller of Des Moines.
And now we turn to your turn. Extend bipartisan support for Bridges to Families. This is by Larry Otterman, who is a lifelong Iowan and an active member of Bread for the World and Bethesda Lutheran Church in Ames. He can be reached at larryotterman@gmail.com. The pandemic exposed the vulnerabilities in our societal safety nets, especially for families with children. It has affected return to work decisions due to the absence of childcare. Most importantly, it has impacted our children and grandchildren, with child hunger skyrocketing to one in four children being food insecure. I am optimistic that bipartisanship can prevail in the current Congress in addressing the problem. Congress recently passed in a bipartisan manner the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, including yes votes by Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican, and Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat. With the failure to pass the Build Back Better Act, President Joe Biden now wants to focus on those parts of that bill that can garner bipartisan support. I believe priority should be given to permanent expansions of the allowance for families with children in the form of child tax credits. but action is urgent as the monthly payments from the expanded child tax credits ended last month. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, passed in 2017 before the pandemic, included a doubling of the child tax credit to $2,000 annually, which recognized the financial pressures on families with children. The American Family Rescue Plan of 2021 further increased the credit to $3,600 for children under age 6 and to $3,000 for those up to age 17. For the first time, it extended the reach of those payments to include those with income too low to file a tax return. The expansion was predicted to reduce child poverty by 40%. Given the payment extension to very low-income families with children, the effects are even more striking in certain racial and ethnic groups, such as Black, Latino, and American Indian people, and Alaska Natives, per the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Without an extension of 91% of Iowa children, without extension, 91% of Iowa children will lose out, and 49,000 may once again sink back below the poverty level. If the expanded credit is extended, a single mother with two young children who is working full-time at minimum wage could receive $6,600 in child tax credits. Without the extension, her tax credit amount returns to $1,800. That is the difference between having to choose shelter over food versus being able to provide both for her young children. The benefits to America from such financial support of families with children has been supported in recent publications from a broad political range of think tanks, such as the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the Niskanen Center, and the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. The groundwork for bipartisan congressional support already exists with the Family Security Act introduced by Senator Mitt Romney, a Utah Republican, in early 2021. That proposes a very similar child payment system. Both conservative and liberal think tanks support such allowances because they are pro-family, pro-life, and a financial bargain given the lifetime costs of poverty. As a member of Bread for the World since 2008, my faith calls me to advocate for policies that move people out of poverty and hunger. If we can reach bipartisan support for our bridges and roads, surely we can reach the same bipartisan support for our families with children. Contact our Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst and your representative and demand they pass legislation quickly. And that was by Dr. Larry Otterman.
And we'll move over to the USA Today opinion page. Its political cartoon today shows a wedding cake, and on the wedding cake it says Flu Rona. And the bride and groom both don't have heads. Their heads are actually a cartoon of the coronavirus spike protein. And the bride thought bubble is saying, cherish me in sickness. And the groom thought bubble says, I flew. This opinion comes from Richard Wolf, former Supreme Court reporter. He writes, the news that Justice Stephen Breyer will retire from the Supreme Court this summer comes as little surprise. Every day he stays on the job is another day Republicans could regain control of the 50-50 Senate and threaten to block his replacement. By refusing to step down during President Joe Biden's first year in office, he pushed back against such calls. The 83-year-old Breyer has played a dangerous game, but he is from a time when one party would not block a high court nomination except for cause, as Democrats tried and failed to do in 1991 when Clarence Thomas was accused of sexual harassment. Most nominees skated to confirmation. Breyer himself whisked through the Senate in 1994 by an 87-9 vote. Those days are over. Breyer's one-year late retirement reaffirms this unfortunate reality. The nation's highest court has become but another political branch, divided between Republican presidents, conservative justices, and Democratic presidents, liberals. The idea that the Supreme Court justices are mere umpires calling legal balls and strikes, as Chief Justice John Roberts claimed at his 2005 confirmation hearing, is laughable. These days, you can predict how nearly all the justices will rule on the most consequential cases, from abortion and affirmative action to guns and religion, based on their political alignment. Gone are the days when Supreme Court justices such as Sandra Day O'Connor or Anthony Kennedy would exhibit such independence. The numbers tell the story. What was a 5-4 conservative court, controlled by the often inscrutable Kennedy until 2018, has become a 6-3 court dominated by Donald Trump's triumvirate. Three is what it is. So here are some bullet points. Neil Gorsuch won Antonin Scalia's seat in 2017 after Senate Republicans blocked Barack Obama's nominee the year before. Brett Kavanaugh moved the court to the right in 2018 when he replaced Justice Kennedy. Amy Coney Barrett moved it much further in that direction after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2020. Justice Ginsburg, beloved by liberals after leading the court's left wing during the last decade of her illustrious career, besmirched her reputation by refusing to step down while President Obama could replace her. By retiring during President Biden's second year in office, Justice Breyer should be able to avoid that legacy. This is not to say the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell and his devotees won't try to gum up the works. But with Democrats in the White House through 2024, it seems unlikely Republicans could block any and all nominees until then. What's more, Biden now has the chance he's been waiting for to put the first black woman on the court, most likely U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson or California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger. This would motivate black voters in this year's midterm elections and in 2024. Some Republicans, at least, may be loath to oppose such an historic nominee. Looking ahead, only Thomas and fellow conservative Justice Samuel Alito are older than 70, so more vacancies could be a long time coming. This would perpetuate conservatives' hold on the court, leaving Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh as the closest thing to swing justices. Breyer's retirement merely freezes the GOP's court majority at 6. It will also deflate further Democrats' hopes of reforming the court by adding additional liberal seats or instituting term limits so that retirements would be scheduled rather than strategic. Those proposals were long shots even before Biden shunted them to a commission, which last month failed to reach any conclusions. Lost quickly in the political debate about the high court's direction will be the erudite Justice Stephen Gerald Breyer, who polls show remains unknown to nearly half the nation, despite 3 decades of behind-the-scenes efforts. He has been a workhorse, not a show horse, and the court is better off for his service. The next few months will be focused on replacing him, replete with all the political hypocrisy we've come to expect. Democrats will extol the new nominee's credentials and demand swift confirmation. Republicans will decry the process and seek to debunk the selection. It will further sully the reputation of a court already plummeting in public opinion polls by making it all seem like politics as usual, which of course it is. And that opinion was from Richard Wolf, a reporter about the Supreme Court.
Also continuing on opinion page, United States wasting too much time against Putin. Passed the Defending Ukraine Sovereignty Act to signal concrete costs before a Russian invasion. And this by Alexander Vindman, who is a former director of European Affairs for the National Security Council. As Vladimir Putin continues to amass troops on the borders of Ukraine, there is a growing sense that the die has been cast and that the invasion is unavoidable. President Joe Biden, in a news conference last week, said, "My guess is he will move in. He has to do something." That may be true, but it does not mean we cannot further complicate Putin's calculus while we still have a chance. At minimum, doing so could delay an invasion, giving Ukraine more time to prepare. At the same time, there is still hope, however slim, that we can deter Putin. We owe it to ourselves and our allies to exhaust every option to deter him before an invasion begins. As a start, Congress must immediately pass the Defending Ukraine Sovereignty Act. This bipartisan legislation already has the backing of the Biden administration, but time is running out to pass it for maximum effect. The legislation includes crippling sanctions against Russia that will trigger upon further military aggression in Ukraine, as well as measures to combat Russia's destabilizing disinformation campaigns. Perhaps most important, the bill mandates a massive and immediate increase in defensive aid to Ukraine. Specifically, the legislation would expedite procurement and delivery of defensive weaponry to Ukraine by using the Special Defense Acquisition Fund and lease programs. On top of the $650 million in defensive weaponry and support that the Biden administration has already committed, the armaments that would swiftly arrive in Ukraine under this legislation would make the prospect of invasion more complicated for Putin. Congress is moving too slowly. Inexplicably, Congress is taking its time on this critical bill. Passage of this legislation before any invasion will be key to its success. Triggered punishing measures must be put in place now to signal the concrete costs of Russian military aggression in Ukraine. We need to ensure that threats of unprecedented sanctions and severe consequences for Russia will prove credible. And yet, following the Senate's marathon session on voting rights, Congress is in recess. When it returns, Congress may find that passage of this bill will come too late. Recognizing time is not on our side, Congress must move this bill immediately and get it to President Biden for his signature. Alongside the provisions of weaponry, the United States should also show greater commitment to holding Putin in check, should he choose to invade. We must deploy for more forces now to Eastern Europe to deter Russian aggression beyond Ukraine and contain the fallout of a major war. Invasion must be costly. Putin must be made to understand that his aggression will be limited, contained, and costly. Deterrence against further aggression and coordinating with our allies will also help prevent a bilateral confrontation involving U.S. troops. Vladimir Putin is an aggressive thinker, but he is not irrational. He will take all that he can as long as the cost is bearable. While diplomatic efforts to dissuade him were necessary and important, they came without the movement of troops and equipment that would have significantly raised the cost of invasion. Thus, he has continued the buildup, possibly to the point of no return. But while there are still seconds on the clock, we can and must act to avert an invasion and the spillover that would suck America into another European war. There is no more time left to waste. And that was by retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who is the former Director of European Affairs for the U.S. National Security Council.